Good afternoon. You are tuned into a Juno Afternoon for Tuesday, the 13th of September, the year 2016. I'm Jeff Brown. I'll be your host for today. We're talking to Clive Thomas about his new collection of essays on Alaskan politics. We'll get a preview of Wednesday's Mudrooms event with Steve Suing. Jane Lindsay will be here to highlight upcoming events at the City Museum. I'll talk with the Human Resources staff about substitute teaching in the Juno School District. That Writer's Almanac. For Renault Music tomorrow on Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Just as Canada's national investigation into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls officially begins, another First Nations woman is missing in Winnipeg. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the 21-year-old has not been seen in 3 weeks.
Christine Wood is from the Oxford House First Nations. She came to Winnipeg with her parents, and after she spent the day shopping with her mother, she went out in the evening and didn't come back. Hundreds of volunteers have searched the city several times, but Wood has lived in the city before while she was a student at the University of Winnipeg. Her mother, Melinda Wood, says they won't give up the search.
I feel so lost in the city. I don't know, like, I just want to find her, and it's so hard not knowing where she is.
The Woods say this is the longest they've gone without speaking to their daughter. They describe Christine as a sweet, shy woman who loved to smile. Supporters say they are trying to show the parents that they are not alone in the city. Renee Shigano is visiting Winnipeg from Toronto. She says she wants to do whatever she can to help.
The more eyes, the more ears, I think it's the better. It's better. And, you know, if it was my family, I would want anybody and everybody to come and help.
A volunteer group known as the Bear Clan has also been scouring the city and handing out posters of the missing woman. Police say they've been receiving tips from the public, but add that the bottom line is that they've not been able to find her. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
People gathered in the Black Hills of South Dakota over the weekend for a ceremony acknowledging the renaming of Harney Peak to Black Elk Peak. Jim Kent was there and has this report.
As the late morning sun slowly starts to warm the chilled mountain air, natives and non-natives form a circle at the base of Black Elk Peak.
We are here to say a thank you prayer.
Paul Stover Soderman is a descendant of William S. Harney, the U.S. Army general who once had the highest mountain east of the Rockies named in his honor. But through the efforts of Lakota elder Basil Braveheart, that mountain was redesignated Black Elk Peak by the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. Standing near Black Elk Peak, Braveheart shares his thoughts.
To me, it's a divine intervention of our career.
One of the primary reasons Braveheart and his supporters requested the mountain be renamed was the massacre of Lakota people in 1855 at Nebraska's Blue Water Creek by U.S. troops under Harney's command. Paul Stover Soderman is pleased he was able to support Basil Braveheart's 2-year effort to remove his ancestor's name from the mountain.
My heart feels good about this, you know, mainly because for the youth, there's going to be some young Lakota children who never knew that this mountain was named after a general who massacred Lakota people in 1855.
I'm Jim Kent.
Native and non-native groups have helped organize a national day of action being called Stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. Events are taking place across the country today, which includes Indigenous people, farmers, and landowners. They're supporting the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which is fighting construction of the pipeline near its reservation in North Dakota. Similar events have been held in recent weeks in cities across the country. Tiffany Brown, who's Oglala Lakota and Turtle Mountain Chippewa, took part in a recent rally in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I've been wanting to go up north so bad. It's been hard for us to try to go up there and stuff. So any way I can try to support and be, you know, let them know that I'm supporting them in prayer and being available, you know, and spiritually if I can't be there.
Many people say Standing Rock's fight against the pipeline is a larger movement among Indigenous people and their non-native neighbors, a united effort to protect water and the environment. Meanwhile, Energy Transfer officials say they're committed to completing construction on the 4-state pipeline project to help reduce U.S. dependence on foreign oil. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at NARF.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a Juno afternoon. First guest is Clive Thomas. He just finished a book, Alaska Politics and Public Policy. Clive, welcome to the station today.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Now, that's not the whole title. Could you explain the whole title, please?
Yeah, the title is Alaska Politics and Public Policy, The Dynamics of Beliefs, Institutions, Personalities, and Power. So it looks at politics through the sort of lens of people's values and beliefs, what we would call political culture in more technical terms. It looks at institutions like the legislature, the executive, local government, and so on. And then it looks at personalities, because basically politics is about personalities. When you strip away the legislature and all the structures, it's about personalities. And it's also about power. Power is a sort of grease, the juice, some people call it, that makes the political process go. So the book is really built around those four ideas, concepts, whatever you call them. And it's meant to not to be a sort of regular or sort of esoteric thing. It's meant to be a book that really gets down to the nuts and bolts of politics in Alaska.
And it's about 3.5 pounds, 2.5 inches high.
It is very big. It's got 30 chapters. It's definitely heavy. You wouldn't want to drop it on your foot. It might be dangerous. But it's, it is very comprehensive. It covers virtually every major topic in Alaska politics. My wife was concerned because there was nothing in there about the arts, but I had to leave out something, and that was one of the things I didn't cover.
It's a collection of essays that you wrote or helped by other people.
Well, it's really, it's. I think it's more than a collection of essays, because the book is really, there are themes that run through the book. The first chapter of the book looks at the general Alaska political environment, the fact that we're non-contiguous state, the role of the Native community, and some things like that. And then chapter two looks at the fundamentals of Alaska politics. And that chapter identifies 12 what I call characteristics of Alaska politics. These include fiscal conservatism, they include the role of Alaska Natives, they include what we call weak political parties versus strong interest groups, it includes three strong branches of government, and other ones. And so each of the chapters refer to those that are relevant to that chapter. And so we've tried to give it a structure, and also to make it more than just a collection of disparate essays. And I think that with the help of the contributors, that was done very well, I think.
Who is the book for?
Well, it's actually, this is an interesting question, because when the University of Alaska Press director approached me about this in 2009, he wanted a book that could cover everyone from AP, advanced placement in high school, right through to graduate students, plus the general public, because there really is no market for several books on Alaska politics in Alaska. We have a very small population. In California, for example, there are 6 or 7 high school books on politics of California, 8 or 10 on state politics. And so I had to cover all those. So basically, it is for those groups. It could be used, and some, probably the biggest market would be social studies teachers. There'd be some market for it in the university system, teaching Alaska politics. I taught Alaska politics here at UAS for 30 years and ran the internship program in the legislature. It would be useful for that. Also, people in government who want to get a view, overview of things. People in the legislature, maybe we'll have a new staffer and they're not familiar with some of the issues, they could read the chapters there. So various people, and the general public, I think, generally.
Now, this book is It's a hefty book, and it's, you say it's one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive book that Alaska, University
well,
of Alaska
yeah,
has put
out. It's probably one of the more extensive ones. I don't know that for certain. I haven't actually had a conversation with it about, but it certainly is the thickest book they've ever produced. And I would guess, I don't know, one of the most expensive books because of the size of it. And there's quite a few tables and graphs and maps, so it probably was. They'd never give me an estimate, but I would figure that.
Contributors include a who's who of Alaska politics. You want to mention some of the names?
Yes, we have. Actually, there are 67 people contributed towards this book, of which 32 did chapters or chapter authors. The others did little inserts or they helped with the book. These people include three governors, Tony Knowles, Bill Sheffield, and before he passed away, Governor Hickel, several legislators, including Senator Wilinkowski, former legislator, Senate President Lyda Green, Harry Crawford, as some people may remember. It includes several lobbyists, one of whom is Wendy Chamberlain, who people may know as a very prominent lobbyist here, former journalists, and a legislator, Mike Dugan, Dave Donaldson, who many people will remember, at least remember his voice from being a political reporter here, APRN reporter here. It includes Fran Ulmer. Fran Ulmer and I did a chapter together. I could guess go on and on, but those are some of the more prominent ones.
What qualities were you looking for in the collection editing process?
Well, what I did is I approached people who I guess you could say are the experts on these subjects in Alaska, the economy, some people from the Institute of Social and Economic Research in Anchorage, which does a lot of research, one of whom is Scott Goldsmith, who is an expert on the Permanent Fund, and Gunnar Knapp, who does a lot on fisheries. But I was looking for people who were sort of the experts on the subject or very knowledgeable, and also people that could do a reasonable job of writing. Not everybody's a very good writer. And so I got those, and I basically sort of stitched it together, you might say, by putting in some of the characteristics of Alaska politics that people missed out, so that it would be, as I said, a fairly integrated and thematic book as opposed to just a collection of disparate essays.
What would you say were the notable events that happened that helped shape Alaska's history? In modern times?
Modern times, Exxon Valdez, I think, probably. Obviously the downturn in oil prices in 2014, big one. Downturn in 86, which of course put oil below $10 a barrel. Other than that, I think that I wouldn't consider big events. I think that a couple ones, just going back a little bit, I think obviously the establishment of the Permanent Fund in 76, first dividend in 82, which has really changed the nature of Alaska politics. And, of course, a little bit more specialized, but I think had major impact, is the Limited Entry Commission in 1972. I think those things have made a lot of difference. In terms of affecting Alaska politics, I think the rise of the environmental movement nationwide has been very significant because Alaska basically is a natural resource extraction economy, and you know, up until the 60s, you could do anything. You could chop down trees, start mines up, and there was really very little concern about the environment, and of course people wanted jobs. Since the 60s, with the rise of the environmental movement, you've got all sorts of conflicts occurring, and in Alaska particularly because of the nature of the environment, because of its pristine beauty, and not everybody wants to go to Iowa, but everyone wants to come to Alaska, and they want to see the beauty and so on. And so the environmental movement has tremendous impact in Alaska, not the homegrown Alaska environmental movement. They're not very strong, but, the Sierra Club, World Wildlife Fund, and they make a lot of difference in this state.
I was thinking of the legislative coup that happened in the 80s.
81, you mean? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure. I mean, if you could weave that into the whole relationship between Bush legislators and the majority, which really started to take off, I think, in the middle 80s and the late 80s. And actually, Andrew Kitchenman did a very, very good report on that a couple of days ago for APRN, I think, here too. I think that made a difference in terms of the way that coalitions work. I think more importantly was, you know, the Democrats had pretty much control of things until the early 90s. And then I think with all sorts of things happening nationwide and, you know, there was a movement towards conservatism. And I think in 94, the Republicans took over. And really, you've had the Democrats have had very little influence since that time. There was, of course, the bipartisan working group. It was both Democrats and Republicans in the Senate between 2007 and 2012. But I think that Alaska is just more conservative, and I think the last session, I think, shows that very much with, you know, the governor trying to put things forward and most of it being beaten down.
I'm talking with Clive Thomas. Wrote a book called Alaska Politics and Public Policy. He's going to be signing copies of the book and doing some talks around town. You want
to I'm actually here, obviously, on behalf of the University of Alaska Press to promote the book. I'm doing a talk on Thursday at the SLAM, just across the road here, and that's a talk on the realities of the Alaska economy, looking at what is possible in terms of economic development here. On on Wednesday evening, I'm doing a 360 North with Andrew Kitchenman, and then on Friday evening from 7 usually to about 8:30, I'm doing a talk, the first kickoff of the season at Juneau, at the UAS campus, an evening Egan, and I'm doing a talk there on can Alaska government be run like a business. And I think a very appropriate topic for the moment because we're searching for some solution to the problems that we've faced for the last 2.5 years with downturn in oil prices, and this is one solution that people sort of come up with, and we're going to look at that question.
In editing the book, did something come at you that surprised you when you're doing your research?
I don't know. Surprised me. You know, I taught Alaska politics for 28 of the 30 years, 32 years I was here. I think that what came home to me is, and I'm being serious now, I wish I'd had this book when I was teaching Alaska politics all those years, because I think it brought together, it integrated many ideas to me, and I think the major thing I think came through, which I've known but I don't think as explicitly, is the sort of what I call the knife edge that Alaska's lived on for 40 years in terms of, you know, oil revenues, and they go down but they come up, and they go down and they come up, and really no long-term plan to be able to deal with what might be very rough times. And I think, I don't know where those rough times have come now since the price of oil dipped in mid-2014, but I think that's the sort of living, I guess, from legislature to legislature and so on. And I understand the politics of why this doesn't happen. I'm not criticizing politicians. I'm just saying that it's a very dicey existence, I think, you know, in that sense. And I think, to me, the very interesting thing is the state has all the wherewithal to deal with this issue, and it doesn't. And once again, I'm not criticizing this. I'm just saying this is a reality of Alaska politics. And I think it came home to me more doing this book than all the things I thought about all the years I was teaching it.
I've been talking with Clive Thomas. Could you go over one more time the places you're going to be at this weekend?
Yeah, I'm going to be at the Nugget Mall Hearthside Books from 3 until 5. Doing a book signing, and then on Friday evening, 7 till 8:30, an evening at Egan at UAS in the library, and on Thursday at noon, I'm doing a talk on the Alaska economy at the SLAM library here, and then tomorrow night I'm doing a program with Andrew Kitchenman on Alaska politics generally, which I think is going to be broadcast later, so...
And this is available through the University of Alaska Press.
Oh, yeah, you can get it from the University of Alaska Press. There's a you can go to the website. There's actually a website which I can give people if they want. It's a very short URL. It's Alaska, spelled out, A-L-A-S-K-A-P-A-S .com. So A-L-A-S-K-A-P for Peter, A for Apple, S for Sam .com, and you know, people can see it there. But you know, I mean, I hope people will buy the book. You don't have to buy the book. The state library has it. I'm sure most libraries will have it, and you know, I'm not going to make any money out of this book. I made very little out of the last one I did 15 years ago. But it'd be interesting for people to read it. I think I have something interesting to say about Alaska politics. And people may disagree with it. So I'd like to hear from them. That's what, you know, intellectual exercises are all about, is discussion and so on. And then, but I think it's very appropriate for the time now because Alaska is facing some really tough times.
Claire Thomas, thank you much for coming down.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Eight stars of gold on a field of blue, Alaska's flag, may it mean to you. The blue of the sea, the evening sky, the mountain lakes and the flowers nearby, the gold of the early sourdough's green, the precious gold of the hills and streams, the brilliant stars in the northern sky, the Bear, the Dipper, and shining high the great North Star with its steady light, o'er land and sea a beacon bright, Alaska's flag to Alaskans dear, the simple flag of Alaska's frontier.
It's 22 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is Steve Suing, here to represent the people from Mudrooms.
Good afternoon, Jeff. I'm happy to be here.
What season is this? Is this sixth season?
Sixth season. We've been going for six strong seasons, and every season gets to be a little bit better, I think. Actually, probably a little bit different, but more people get to know Mudrooms and get in front of the Mudroom stage, and we're excited to be starting up. It's one of the sure signs of fall.
So since it's been a few months since you've done your last event, could you tell people, what is Mudrooms?
Yes. So Mudrooms is a community storytelling event, and it happens at the Northern Lights United Church. We do it once a month, and the storyboard, made up of seven people, come up with some themes that are general in nature. And then we go out in the community, recruit people that might have a story about that specific theme. If they're a little bit nervous about their story, we give them a little bit of coaching, and then the event happens. And this event tomorrow is our first event, as we just stated, and the theme is Chechako. So we have found seven people in the Juneau community. Some of them have some storytelling experience, some of them don't, that have a story that has to do with the theme Chechako.
So this is seven people, seven stories, $7 to get in.
That's correct. Seven people, seven stories. They're 7 minutes in duration, so it's a pretty tight program. It starts at 7 p.m., usually ends around 8:30. And a $7 cash donation at the door. And over the course of five seasons, we've passed on the money directly to nonprofits in the community. And to date, we've raised over $60,000 because of this event that went to the organizations in the community.
There was a benefiting organization this week.
The benefit organization for these first four events is going to be the Zach Gordon Youth Center. They've got a foundation that takes care of some financial support and volunteer support, and the money is going to go directly to them.
Who's selling stories this time around?
This time around, we've got Tanya Peters, Nico Buss, Candace Bressler, Tony Newman, Jim Hale, Tom Kelly, and Graham Story.
Some of these have experience telling stories.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, the Mudrooms, you know, I think I've told stories twice on the Mudroom stage, and I think that when someone comes to the stage and offers something personal in nature, I think it really makes a good connection with the audience and kind of makes a full experience. This theme is kind of interesting in that when we chose it, half of the people in the room knew what Chechako was, but as we went out and recruited people in the community, we figured out that, you know, we thought it was a common term, but a lot of people aren't familiar with it. So it's a tenderfoot or greenhorn or just someone that's a newcomer to Alaska. So these should be some very interesting stories about first experiences in the great state of Alaska.
Starts at 7 o'clock at Northern Lightning United Church. And get some music, too.
Yeah. We are super excited. Whenever I see this group anywhere in Juneau, I'm super excited. They add warmth to wherever they're at, the Njuzu Marimbas. And that alone is worth the price of admission. So we're looking forward to having them take the stage.
What should people expect when they come to Mudrooms?
Arrive early. We start promptly at 7 p.m. At the Northern Lights Church. You know, the crowds vary in size. But part of the Mudrooms experience is not only about what's happening on the stage, but the connection the audience makes, and also the connections before and after. So this is a wider range cross-section of the Juneau population, from young people that are, you know, maybe my sons are going tomorrow night, and they're 5 and 8. To people that are in their late teens, early 20s, and people's in their 50s and 60s. So a lot of the times during the fall and winter months when we're a little bit more homebound, this is definitely a point of connection for folks that they look forward to seeing their friends and neighbors and making new friends and neighbors at these Mudrooms events.
And it's broadcast after it's been edited slightly on KTVO on the fourth Thursday of every month at 7 o'clock.
Yep, that's correct. The 22nd of this month, this show will go on air. We do some editing of it, so it fits into neatly into an hour, splice in some music from the marimbas in this case, and then it gets to air again on KTO. So lots of things happening in Juneau tomorrow night. So if you can't make it to the actual event, you will get a chance to hear it again. And also, all the stories are archived at mudrooms.org. So if there was a story that you heard 3 years ago that was absolutely amazing that you want to hear again, maybe you're a potential storyteller and want to get up some courage, so you want to listen to a couple stories to get that, you can find all those archived at mudrooms.org.
Steve Searing, anything you want to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I do want to add something, and that's thank yous. Northern Lights United Church has been a great host facility for Mudrooms. This will be the third year. COPA has been a big supporter. Mark Wheeler was one of the originally storyboard members. The Rookery, John Hutchins, who takes photographs that we post on our Facebook page and also our internet site, mudrooms.org. KTO has been a great partner in rebroadcasting, letting us come on Juneau afternoon and pitch what's happening with Mudrooms. And I think that's about it. Looking forward to seeing Juneau once again filled with stories. We do have plenty of openings for the upcoming season. All of our themes and the opportunity to sign up is at mudrooms.org. Make sure you like our Facebook page because upcoming events, it's good to have reminders and things that are happening with Mudrooms inside and outside of our events.
Steve, thanks for coming down.
Thanks, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 13th of September, 2016. It's the birthday of the British novelist and playwright J.B. Priestley, born in Bradford, Yorkshire, 1894. Fought in World War I, lost many of his friends, killed in combat, never wrote about the war, remained nostalgic for the pre-war years. He wrote more than 120 books, most notably the novels The Good Companions, Bright Day, and Lost Empires. J.B. Priestley, who said, "Most writers enjoy two periods of happiness, when a glorious idea comes to mind, and secondly, when a last page has been written and you haven't had time to know how much better it ought to be." It's the birthday of Sherwood Anderson, born Camden, Ohio, 1876, author of Winesburg, Ohio, about life in a small Midwestern town. It's the birthday of Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass, born in Rosine, Kentucky, 1911. He was the youngest of eight kids. His brothers claimed all the popular instruments, like fiddle and guitar, before he came along, so he took up the mandolin. His mother died when he was 10. His father died a few years after that. So Bill Monroe moved in with his uncle, Pendleton Vandiver, who played fiddle at dances in the area. Bill Monroe wrote a song about him. "Oh, the people would come from far away to dance all night to the break of day. When the caller would holler, 'Do-si-do,' they knew Uncle Penn was ready to go. Late in the evening, about sundown, high on the hill and above the town, Uncle Penn played the fiddle. Lord, how it rang. You could hear it talk, you could hear it sing." He formed a band, the Bluegrass Boys, 1938. Most of the greats of bluegrass played in it at one time or another. Don Reno, Mack Wiseman, Jimmy Martin, Carter Stanley, Vassar Clements, Pete Rowan, Chubby Wise, Byron Burline, Earl Scruggs, Lester Flatt, Del McCurry, Roland White, and Doug Green. And it's the birthday of the pianist and composer Clara Schumann, born Leipzig, Germany, 1819, married the composer Robert Schumann on the eve of her 21st birthday. She was already a very popular pianist of the time. Her concerts sold out. She was compared to Beethoven. She continued playing long after his death, played her last concert, 1891, at the age of 72. Here's a poem for today by Peter Maycock entitled Flu Days. Shivering, you drag yourself as if gunshot to the living room, to the old movie channel, to a Bogart festival, your mind fogged over like the street on the screen, edging toward feverish sleep when Bogey snarls at Ida Lupino of all the 14-carat saps. Hours later, when you wake, he's smacking Peter Lorre. When you're slapped, you'll take it and like it. And as if cuffed, you black out, head pounding, and come to upon Ingrid Bergman. And you must remember this before fading again, then back to Bogey, hacked to death by Bedoya's machete, all that gold dust blown away with the whole bloody day, everything gone, gone black, as your living room windows, those previews of the big sleep. Flu Days by Peter Maycock from Mandatory Evacuation, published by Boa Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Rotary Club of Juneau is proud to present the 5th Annual Capital Brewfest coming September 17th at the Jack from 1 to 5 p.m. Even more brewers from across Alaska this year, as well as great local music and food. Proceeds benefit the humanitarian works of Rotary and Juneau Stop Heroin Start Talking. Come and drink beer for a cause. Tickets are limited and this event will sell out, so buy yours at capbrewfest.com.
It's 34 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into it Juneau afternoon here for Tuesday, the 13th of September in the year 2016. Our next guests are from the City Museum, Kathy Connor, Mike Blackwell, and Jean Lindsay. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you for having us.
So you got a lot of things going on.
A lot of things going on.
Why don't you tell us about some of them?
Well, I will just tell you about one that's actually happening tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the museum. It's called Geo Juno, All About Our Rocks and How They've Shaped Our Towns. And I've actually brought the two presenters down to talk with y'all, Mike Blackwell and Kathy Connor.
Here, Mike.
Yes. We're going to talk about geology for a while, Juno's geology, and in a non-technical style, outline the distribution of rocks and glaciers and other things and why they're here and how they have influenced our town and its development and, to some extent, the way we live.
What's the most common rock in Juneau?
I'll have to ask Connie.
Diorite. That's the black and white Dalmatian rock, you know, that comes off the glacier. I think that one, or maybe slate, around downtown in Douglas.
And Kathy, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, there's so many wonderful Juneau characters that interweave with the mining and the landscape formation and the villages having to go up and down because of sea level rise and all that. I think we're going to try and show you how we wouldn't be who we are today if it wasn't for this funny, earthy landscape that we ended up with a lot of uplift, a lot of crashing plates, and these poor glaciers just had their way with, you know, all the faults and things around here. So having the gold showing up at the surface just added to the whole crazy plot of this place. It's kind of like a good melodrama, geo-melodrama, I think.
And when is that happening?
Tomorrow, September 14th, at the museum. We're located at 4th and Main Streets at 7 p.m., and it's free.
And what are other things coming up at the City Museum?
Well, actually, we are winding down our summer hours. So winter hours will begin September 27th. And winter hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And because, once again, we have wonderful free admission sponsors, I can give you the rundown of every month, October through April, that we actually have sponsors who are opening our doors free of charge for repeat visits. And they are in October. So beginning October 1 is the Pioneers of Alaska Men's and Women's Igloo 6. This is going to be their seventh year of sponsoring free winter admission for the month of October. November, we have a few sponsors that have come together, and it's in celebration of Dr. Walter Sobolev Day, November 14th. So all of November, open free of charge. Think about that great man who lived in our community and influenced Alaska so wonderfully. December is Robert and Michelle Storer. This is, they usually do 3 months every year, and this is their 14th year of sponsoring 3 months. So their December, their March, and their April. So in January, we have Don and Alma Harris. This is their seventh year. And then we also have February 2017 is in memory of Harold O. Fossum, who we credit with sort of the beginning of this great tradition. He actually left part of his estate to the museum, which is pretty fabulous. And so we put some of that money into free winter admission every year so that we can always honor him with a month.
Why can't I give you volunteering at the City Museum?
About 10 years.
What's your favorite thing to do there?
Currently, in the summer, I escort walks around town. And we talk about Juneau history and some of the people and sites that are part of that history. It's usually a mixture of locals and visitors, and it's a lot of fun.
But how many people on this typical walk?
Oh, ranging from 4 to 12 this summer.
And what's their most common question?
Oh, nothing pops into my mind. It's kind of a continuum, and I can't think of any high points. It's all one big celebration of Juneau's history.
Cool. Yes?
Well, there's one thing I'd like to mention. We have been sponsoring the Juneau History Grant for several years now, and a few years ago we went ahead and put it on quarterly application cycles. So we are taking applications September 30th. So if you're interested in a project that brings out unique Juneau history, develops a new concept, is something that we are really just co-supporting. We typically give anywhere from $500 to $1,500 for these grant projects. And give me a call, 586-3572, if you'd like to talk about a project. We do have some information on our website as well.
And how many volunteers do you have there?
You know, we're in the 20-ish. Yeah. And that's a range of front desk volunteers who come in for a few hours every week to be at the front desk and greet visitors and chat with them. And I have to say, if you take a look at the City Museum on TripAdvisor, our volunteers they get very high ratings for being friendly. They're interested in the community. They take the time to talk to visitors. So very high marks. And then folks like Mike, who they lead walking tours. We have volunteers who do that. And then, of course, Mike and Kathy helped us develop a rocks and minerals exhibit, which is why they're coming to do GeoJuno tomorrow night, is to just sort of talk about this exhibit and the different rocks and minerals in our area and how they affect our lives. So it's a nice presentation to in tandem with this new exhibit where there's hands-on rocks and mineral touch.
How long is the exhibit open for?
Actually, that's a permanent exhibit. It's in our hands-on history mining room, and that exhibit now lives in that room.
And you're going to start to do the breakfast, the coffee and collections.
Yes, we are. Coffee and collections are coming in October, of course. October 7th, we'll have a First Friday with David Witte. We're actually closing his exhibit, but we're going to get together and welcome everyone back to look at his work. It's just a beautiful exhibit. And then October 8th, a pretty special thing is going to happen. The Empty Chair Committee, as many people know, they raised quite a bit of funds. They also got a grant. And they wrote a book. Carlene Grummet wrote a book called Quiet Defiance, The Empty Chair Story. And that book, they're going to be doing a book signing at the museum on October 8th at 10:30 to noon. And everyone who comes is, my understanding, going to get a free copy of the book. And that's sort of wrapping up this project that they've done for, the last 3 or 4 years to put a memorial up at Capitol Park, the exhibit we did at the City Museum. And now, just sort of culminating event is this book. So that's going to be happening. And also on October 22nd from 10:30 to noon, a coffee and collections. Marie Darlin is going to be bringing in folks who've actually lived through some of the disasters in our disasters exhibits, photos that we have in the museum. And they're just going to be talking about some of these events in their lives, and that's on the 22nd. And, of course, coffee is sponsored by Heritage Coffee Company and is free for everyone, and the coffee and collections are free.
When is the Ernest Greening exhibit going
on? Oh, when is that? It's coming. It's coming, Jeff. We'll be back. Sorry? Yeah.
Kathy, you want to update us on anything?
I would just add that my favorite parts of the City Museum after the wonderful geology and mining room displays are the fish trap that was pulled out of the mouth of Montana Creek, and then the rebuilt model that Steve Hendrickson and Janny did. That's a wonderful thing. The wonderful also ski history of Juneau up in the bowl, Dan Muller bowl up there. And from a tourist perspective, I've heard that you have the best bathrooms in town. So
you know, there's considering how much use they get and how small our museum is, those walls are pretty attractive. So we have done our best to make the whole experience of coming to the museum, you know, an educational and historic one.
Well, there's something I didn't know.
Yeah, Jeff, you got to come up and use the restroom.
I'll make a point. I've been talking with Kathy Connor, Mike Blackwell, and Jane Lindsay about the City Museum. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, no. Come and visit us and come to GeoJuno tomorrow, 7 p.m. at the City Museum. We're looking forward to seeing everybody, and we'll see you tomorrow.
All right. Thanks for coming by, everybody.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. The change of seasons lends our lives a fundamental rhythm. One of the easiest ways to keep a finger on the pulse of the seasons is to keep an eye on the birds. As you look into your yard each day or take a favorite walk, take note of which birds happen by. When do the first swallows of spring flit overhead? As fall comes on, when do the juncos return from the mountains, ready to pick up at the bird feeder where they left off last year? When do you hear migratory Canada geese flying overhead in the darkening autumn sky? Keeping a simple diary of the seasons can be gratifying. A blank book kept handy on the counter will suffice. The day-to-day changes you jot down will bring you in touch with the annual ebb and flow of nature just outside your window. And keeping track over the years will deepen your attunement. You'll discover that a Swainson's thrush starts to sing on almost the same day each year. You'll be able to anticipate the date when the chickadees will again bring their new brood to the feeder. I'm Mary McCann. You can get BirdNote as a podcast. Sign up on our website, birdnote.org.
Support for KTOO programming is provided by Arnold Liebelt, candidate for City and Borough of Juneau Assembly. Paid for by Liebelt for Assembly, P.O. Box 240881 Douglas. Steve Ricci, Chair.
It's 45 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to a Juneau afternoon. My last guest for today is the Director of Human Resources at the Juneau School District, Ted Van Bronckhorst. Thank you for coming in, Ted.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
So what does a human resources person do?
The human resources department manages all the personnel activities within the school district, which would include hiring, retention, all matters related to personnel.
And today we're talking about substitute teaching.
In particular, yes.
Tell us a little bit about substitute teaching in the school district.
Well, we always have a need for substitute teachers. We're always looking for ways to try and expand the pool of substitutes. And at this time of year, we have a particular high need. This is the time of year when we haven't gotten all of our substitutes back from seasonal jobs. And so we always have needs in the classroom, either for paraeducators or teachers.
What does a person need to know or available in their history to be a substitute teacher?
Well, the minimum qualifications are a high school diploma and to be able to pass a background check. So the minimums are very attainable. Beyond that, if a person has more education, more advanced training, or has experience working with children, that's always a plus.
Any changes in the current program?
Yeah, we've got a couple of changes that are pretty exciting and in one case long overdue. The overdue matter is that of substitute pay. We've been able to increase the subpay this year for all of our substitutes. So we're pleased about that because we appreciate our subs and hope they'll continue to work with us. The other very exciting prospect is that we are now engaged in a partnership with UAS, University of Alaska Southeast, in the development of a substitute training course. So this will be a one-credit class that anyone could take. The district will support those who take it, and for substitutes who take it and pass, they'll be able to get a small hourly increase as well.
How do you recruit people to be substitute teachers?
Most of our recruitment is done word of mouth, but we also have a presence, of course, on the district website, and we have ads in various publications around the Alaska Teacher Placement, et cetera. We have ads up for vacancies. Also, we have an ad on at the movie theaters right now for substitute teachers.
What are the hours?
Well, there are no minimum hours. There's no maximum, really, either. So a person could choose to work in any area of town, in any content area, at any level. They could choose to work in elementary or in secondary. So it's very flexible, and a person could work one day a week or they could work every single day of the week if they wanted. So it's very flexible indeed.
About how many substitute teachers do you have in the district?
Well, on the list, we probably have about 170 on the list. Some of those are relatively very active and some are less active. And just this year, we've enrolled about 30 new substitute teachers. And from that list, we also hire permanent employees. So we've this year already hired almost 10 of those substitute teachers into permanent positions.
I realize it's probably against the law to ask them their age, but about what are the age ranges for substitute teachers?
Any age at all. We have a lot of retired people. We have people as young as college students at UAS or other places that work during the holiday or when they're out of class. So any age at all is wonderful. You just have to enjoy working with children.
And what are the ages of the classes?
could be anywhere from pre-kindergarten, 3-4-year-old, up to an 18-year-old in high school. So all ages, pre-K through 12. And we have needs in classrooms at every one of those ages almost every day.
What's the process? Teacher wakes up in the morning, I got a cough, I can't come in. And then they call you, and then you have to call a substitute teacher.
Yeah, actually, if they call up before their report time, then they log into what is called ASOP, which is our it's an online substitute program tool that allows us to make a match between substitutes and the needs that we have in the district. So subs can go right online, see what vacancies are open, and they can either with an app on their phone or online accept vacancies, accept jobs.
How do people get started as a sub?
It's very easy to get started. That's the good part. All you need to do is go on the Juneau School District website, fill out an application, and get that turned in, and then come down to the district office, complete a couple of simple payroll forms, and we'll get you right started.
What drew you to being a human resources director?
I'd been in education for about 20 years or so before, and the opportunity presented itself in the district I was working in, and I had kind of always watched the HR director while he was doing the job, and it seemed like something that I would enjoy and be good at, so I applied for that job, and so that's what I've been doing for about the last 12 years.
Do you handle people from the janitorial staff all the way to the teachers?
All employees. So that would be all teachers, administrators, and classified staff, which includes your custodians and office assistants and everyone in the district.
Now, here's one you may not have the answer to on the top of your head. How many people are there employed by the school district?
We have around 325 teachers and around 300 classified and about 20 administrators. So roughly speaking, 630 or 40 employees.
What's your favorite part about coming to work in the morning?
My favorite part for sure is just being able to work with people, talk to them about challenges and problems they're having on the job, and see if the Human Resources Department can help them solve some of those problems. We get challenges every single day, and that's the most gratifying part, is just being able to assist people in their daily work.
Is this information available online?
Absolutely. For being a substitute? Absolutely, yep. There's the application, as I said, right on the new website, and that it's easy to fill out and get turned in. So, yes, there is that information online as well.
I've been talking with Ted Van Bronckhorst about substitute teachers in the school district. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I would just add that in addition to being a good way to pick up some extra money, being a substitute teacher is a great way to get started in the field of education. If you think it's something you might consider as a career, there's a great chance to get started and see if you like it.
Ted, thank you for coming by.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Treat her right, or she won't be at home when you call. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, show me a woman that a man can trust. You got to see your mama every night. You can't see your mama at all. Thank you.
do it, ladies and gentlemen.
Fiddler Williams.
The Juno Arts and Humanities Council, in partnership with KTOO, is thrilled to bring Grammy-nominated musician Madis Yahoo to Juno on September 23rd. Expect an intimate, supercharged performance that blends reggae, beatboxing, hip-hop, singer-songwriting, and a whole lot of soul. Tickets at the Jack and Hearthside Books. Madis Yahoo in Juno, September 23rd.
You've been listening to a Juno Afternoon for today. Tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon, Scott Burton will be your host. We'll get an update on Girl Scout activities with guest Ann Kurland. Patrick Murphy will be here with a preview of Hank Williams' birthday tribute celebration this weekend at the Red Dog. We'll also learn about Aware's advocacy training, which starts on Thursday. And we'll get a preview of Saturday's Discover Eagle Crest Day. The Wednesday hike for September 14th is the Peterson Lake Trail. This moderate tour is 9 miles round trip to the cabin with an approximate 600-foot elevation gain. The first 2 miles of the new trail is on new trail and the rest will be mud. The late lunch at the cabin, boards may be so slippery to bring grippers in case they're needed. Meet at 24.5-mile Glacier Highway at 9:30 in the morning. No dogs or firearms. Carpooling is strongly encouraged. The forecast for tonight, scattered showers. Forecast for Wednesday, scattered showers. Thursday, rain likely before 7 in the morning, then showers between 7 and 4.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on Translators K276A.